Lil, put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
And as ever, it's time to have another joyous example of the Emerald Isle analogues and travelogues of Jenny Finch with another Tipperary tale.
Hello there. This episode is from November 2021. We are slowly chipping away at all the stuff that needs doing and are surprised at the end of each week at how much we've managed to do. This week, we had some help in the form of Will and Anthony, two of Derek Madden's merry men. They were the crew who helped us move in back in February, and they turned up on Wednesday to do a blitz job on some of the most pressing areas of the garden and surrounds. They had intended coming on Monday, but the weather took a turn for the worst, and the jobs were not the sort you want to do in pouring rain and high winds. It was still a bit uncertain when they arrived, but these two lovely men tackled the Majestic, moved some of the wood into dry, put more weed mat over the side ground, cleared out the gutters, and then tackled the front hedge. This had gone feral over the summer, and the poor postie was in danger of losing an eye trying to get through. Well, what a difference a day makes. They were quite apologetic, saying it was a bit ragged, but it was way better than we expected. The growth has been enthusiastic but random, and it'll take a year or so to thicken up. Then we can think about shaping it a bit more. Will and Anthony did an amazing job, even putting a bit of a slope on the front. It was too wet to tackle the grass, but hopefully they might come back when we have a few fine days and work their magic on the back garden too. They also made Jackie's day. We explained we were struggling with these heavier jobs, with Jackie's health and our slowly advancing age. When they heard how old Jackie was, they paid a great Irish compliment. "Geez, but you're fresh." Another for the language list, I think. We have had a number of encounters with our neighbours this week. At the weekend, we met Des from the farm across the field. We had already made friends with his partner, Julie, and she brought him around to meet us and to discuss some help maintaining the garden after the blitz. A highly skilled gardener and tree man, Des is much in demand, and we are pleased he might consider our sad little patch. He's very interested in the wood and could be a godsend when we finish the cutting down phase and move on to the building back bit. On two separate days, we met more neighbours. Remember, this means anyone who lives closer than 3 kilometres away. Noreen was walking along the track one day as we came back from town. She was without her little dog, Brandy, this time, but I'm getting a bit better at recalling human names. We had a nice chat, and it's very reassuring to have a nurse for a neighbour, especially one so helpful. Yesterday, we met the man who walks Rocky, his friend's dog, an exception to my name recall at the moment. He was the walker who stopped us early on and asked if I was the writer lady. He commented on my bicycle, which had been out of the shed for a bit on Wednesday. It transpires he spent 50 years in the bicycle trade and identified and admired it immediately. I've just got a proper stirrup pump for it and should be able to ride it again when the weather clears. Turns out there's a locking joint on the valves of Dutch bikes and I need to turn this or 'twill never be pumped up, you know. Well, I do now. No wonder I was popping my shoulders with a stupid little pump. Also, his wife is the woman who makes the jam we love and always get at the Friday markets. A small world, Ireland. We're starting to make connections with and between people too. The bins are another story. In fact, they are several stories, ranging from health and safety to the driver lost his bonus collecting them and won't come down the lane anymore. I'm hoping to have a little word with the closure department tomorrow and we'll give the details then. Meanwhile, we're hunting for someone, anyone, who will do a rubbish and recycling collection. Keep your fingers crossed for us. It's getting a bit desperate. Finally, a question for those of an ornithological incline. We have another new bird in the garden. In fact, it hops along the fence and peers in through the windows, not in the least scared by us or the dogs. It looks a bit like a wren in body shape and beak, but it's at least 50% larger. It has a sparrow-like back and wings, but a black, very dark grey hair, white flash on its throat, white smudge in its chest, and a russet belly. The tail can be fanned out, and it takes delight in twerking at us, a bit like a wagtail. I've tried to get a picture, but failed miserably. Anyone got any ideas? The blog for the next week was a day late, for good reason. We went to get another vital part of the new grooming room and got hopelessly lost. We headed into County Cork using the main roads, but around one town there were diversions and roadworks. Anxious to avoid a side trip into Cork itself, we moved onto smaller roads. Big, big mistake. We drove for over an hour through a maze of tiny roads. Many were not on the map, and they had only road numbers, which were also not on the map. The only signposts were to places, not on the map. And several signs were knocked down or moved round, so sent us in the wrong direction. In the end, it was a 7-hour trip, but the countryside was lovely. So were the people we went to see. So it was just a long Sunday drive, really. We're firmly into autumn now, and the leaves are tumbling. For a few weeks, there were beautiful displays of colour, then piles of vegetation around the house. Many of the changes are the same as in England. The swifts have left, the starlings are back in force, and all the birds are eating as if they're starved. There are more colours here on the trees, as a lot of homes have maples, beech, and rowan, among others, and they go a glorious red. We're hoping to plant some American maple and copper beech next year to replace the heart of the wood. Hopefully we can add some fruit trees and perhaps a hazelnut or two. They will feed the birds as well. Mind you, we missed the amazing display of trees around Middlesbrough. There you are. Not a sentence you ever thought you'd hear, right? Well, when local councils were awarded a grant for planting trees many years ago, Middlesbrough decided to use theirs to green the main roads, especially the A174. The planting is inspired, with a wonderful mix of trees giving an amazing show for weeks. There are other differences here. For the first year since 1989, we had no Halloween callers. This is not all that surprising. Despite having a number of neighbours just across the road, they are actually up to 3 kilometres away, and it's not an easy 3K either. It was a stormy night, pouring with rain, and the road was deep in mud and potholes. Bit of a hike for a handful of chocolates, I think. Also, there's no 5th of November, so we're spared the fireworks that seem to begin in late September and end after New Year in England. We are lucky that our dogs don't mind the noise. The oldest used to get up at the window and pull the curtains aside to look out at them. Charlie grew up with the TV on as a puppy, so he's used to loud noises and sudden bangs. Maybe that's why he's hypervigilant towards strangers. He's expecting someone to ride into the house all guns blazing. I suspect we're heading for a pre-Christmas circuit breaker lockdown here in Ireland. COVID cases are rising fast, and there is a hint of returning to work from home for many people. We hope to learn from our previous experiences, and we'll do our non-essential shopping next week. We are also bringing the new freezer inside and putting it into the little utility room so we can bulk buy the dog's meat and freeze it. Getting enough was a nightmare last time, and only one supermarket will come up here to deliver. I'm also getting a job lot of overseas stamps, so if I have your address, I can send a card this year. We're still fighting with the waste collectors, who are coming to remove the bins despite not telling us why or answering our emails. As no one else operates in the area, I'm at a loss and very angry. Still, we've overcome much greater obstacles in the last year, and I'm sure we can sort this out somehow. Meanwhile, I'm composing an icily polite letter of complaint that will go to them, their trade association, the local council, and if necessary, the Environmental Protection Agency. Have a good week, and thank you for listening.
Wondrous in so many ways, delightful and wondrous. And just a little caveat, of course, that if you're thinking, what, Christmas? Where's it all going? What's happening? In all sorts of ways. Jessica Burtis in North Carolina, what did you make of the latest Tipperary tale?
I loved it. And I have just grown to absolutely adore hearing about your garden progress. I think it's so fascinating. And I hope that the waste collectors, sort themselves out, and that goes very smoothly. I hope your letter makes a good impact on that. But I just loved hearing all the details. And I was shocked when you said that it was no trick-or-treaters because of the 3 kilometers. That would be a hike.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you ever take walks down the lane to kind of go walking between houses?
Yes, people do. Noreen with her little dog, they walk about 2 kilometers each way, so 4 kilometers a day, or 3 or 4 times a week. And a lot of walkers walk the loop, which is a 5 kilometer loop that goes down our road. Then they turn left, they walk a little way up, then they turn left again, and then back down to their houses. So we've got 2 cottages to the right of us at the other end of our road, 2 cottages to the left of us at the bottom, and then houses every 400 or 500 yards dotted along to the left at the top. So there's maybe about a dozen neighbours in that circle, and that's it.
It sounds nice. You have like neighbors, but you also have your space.
Yes. Yes. I can't believe the amount of space we have here. We had a 10 by 10 backyard in Saltburn, and now we've got 1.3 acres, which is quite a lot of ground, especially when it all grows like mad, which it does.
It's all that rain.
It's raining today and everything's going mad again.
Of
yes.
Of course.
It was beautiful yesterday. Lovely, glorious sunshine.
And of course, Jessica, this is the Emerald Isle that you'll be heading off to in a matter of months now. Has the countdown started?
Yes, and the pressure is seriously on to get a plane ticket that's the perfect one. So I'm getting nervous, got to start my packing list. But then I'll be back in one of the most beautiful places, so it's worth it.
So there we are, on the same land, etc. Jenny, as ever, a delight. A reminder, how can people actually follow you in terms of the socials and so on?
Right. My website is Jenny Finch, J-E-N-N-I-E, Finch, like the bird, at jennyfinch.me.uk. And I also have a Facebook page under Jenny Finch, and you can see a picture of me in an utterly disgraceful jacket on that.
And Jessica, any thoughts in terms of the anonymous bird that twerks? I mean, I thought she was describing Miley Cyrus for a moment, but obviously I was wrong.
Yeah, so I'm really curious about that too. I've been trying, so I receive emails from the Audubon Society because I've been trying to learn more about birds because my parents put out a lot of things in the backyard for them. And it can be really hard to identify some of the species. But I'd love to know which kind you have around you, because I just know in Ireland there are a ton of magpies that love to go around, and they're huge. But I'm curious about what the bird is, but he clearly likes you both.
We have a lot of birds come and sit on the fence and peer in through the window. They're very nosy. We have robin and that does that every morning. We've got half a dozen blackbirds nesting in the garden. We've got a flight of goldfinches. And we think this little one was probably either a young bullfinch or a young chaffinch. We've also got buzzards, of course. And rooks, though they call them crows over here. Masses of great flights of rooks. The buzzards are fun.
That's so cool that you call them rooks. We call them crows over here too, but rook is such a cool name for them. I never knew that.
They say if you see a rook on its own in a field, it's a crow. And if you see a lot of crows together, they're rooks. They're two slightly different birds.
I didn't know that. That's so interesting. I just learned something new. Thank you.
And to think they all came from dinosaurs, a whole new world. Millie Hill is joining us in a few moments to talk about how the media sometimes actually makes giving birth appear to be a very terrifying experience.
Jessica Burtis flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
Did you know that in 1991, a bill was passed by the North Carolina Senate changing the official proportions of the state flag from a length one-third more than its width to a length one-half more than its width?
Wow, there must not be a lot going on in the North Carolina Senate for them to have that kind of time on their hands.
It's fair to say that barely a day goes by without the media taking flak for one reason or another. And in many cases, that's quite rightly the case. But what about the notion of giving birth? And can that actually traumatise people and provide folk with a reason to effectively say, that's it, never again, never for me? Now, clearly, I'm not probably the ideal person to talk about this, but the person who is ideally placed to talk about this is indeed the terrific author of the fabulous text, The Positive Birth Book, and the author of Give Birth Like a Feminist, the amazing Millie Hill. How are you, Millie?
I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me. Hi.
Well, it's great to have you on board. And certainly it's an interesting line that you raised, because I must admit, I was thinking back over the portrayal of childbirth. And normally, and this goes back decades really, you get push, 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 and all sorts of other scenarios. And it does seem as though it's a trauma of extraordinary situations, which clearly could well impact folk who actually sort of say, not for me, absolutely not for me.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you raise the kind of push, push, push thing, because, you know, that's a really typical thing that we see on soap operas and, television dramas when someone's having a baby. But actually, the reason that evolved is because of the epidural. So if you've had an epidural, which is fine if that's your choice, but that if you've had one, you can't feel below your waist. So you need somebody to tell you when and how to push. That's the whole point of the epidural, that it takes away all sensation. But if you haven't had an epidural, you don't need anyone to do that. So the fact that, you know, it's become a kind of de rigueur part of childbirth is really, you know, sums it all up, really, that, you know, we see this happening and we assume women can't give birth without someone telling them how to do it. But actually, you know how to do it. Every woman knows how to have a baby. It's in you. And sometimes that sort of people cheerleading around the bed shouting push thing can be really off-putting. And it can also make you feel like you don't know what you're doing, which is quite disempowering.
Is this just a case of lazy script writers? Is this a case of, I mean, you cite the BBC's This Is Going to Hurt. I mean, even the very name actually carries with it connotations of, really? Oh dear, what's going to happen with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just lazy script writers. I think it is actually what birth is often like. But the problem with that is it sets us on a loop of, this is what we see, how we see birth represented, therefore this is how we do it, and therefore this is what it's like. You know, and This Is Going Hurt is based on his real life experiences, but they're based on his experiences as a doctor. And I think what I'm trying to say is we need to change the narrative. We need to get the message to women that birth doesn't have to be this disempowering, terrifying, you know, events in which you feel you don't have any voice or any control. And, you know, when you come out the other side of it, you think, thank God that's over. For many women, it can be a real change-making experience in their lives where they, you know, suddenly feel powerful in a new way. And, you know, it doesn't really matter whether where you choose to have your baby or how you choose to have your baby. Ultimately, at the moment, we've got a situation where about one in three women are coming to the other side of childbirth reporting that being traumatized. And many other women beyond that figure are feeling that's a day I'd rather forget. So we're not getting it right for women. And I think that's the message, is that birth doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be a negative experience. Wherever you choose to have your baby and however you choose to have your baby, it should be an experience that you cherish, and an experience in which you feel cherished. You feel, you know, like the queen of the room, like everyone is taking care of you in this beautiful experience, which is a rite of passage. You're stepping over the threshold to become a mother, and it's a huge day in your life. Most women don't forget it. I mean, I've spoken to women in their 80s who still remember all the details of the day they had their babies. So we need to do better for women.
Tocophobia is a word I wasn't familiar with, but that's the fear of pregnancy and birth from that point of view. Is it a case in your own research, Millie, that people have actually been so badly affected by this that they've literally wanted to avoid starting a family altogether?
Yes, I've worked with women who have such severe tocophobia that they have terminated pregnancies. So it can be extremely damaging, and that's obviously an extreme example. But I do think it affects women, and I think sometimes it's a case of women having one baby and saying, "I'm not going to have any more." Mm-hmm. So it's not always tocophobia, you know, in its purest sense. Sometimes it's just being completely put off the experience and never wanting to repeat it. Which is a terrible situation, really, isn't it? We don't really want a situation where even one woman has to feel like that.
Now, you've obviously got three children. From your own personal experience, and I know you founded the positive birth movement as well, as a kind of, not a, a remedy, but kind of an alternative viewpoint from that point of view, were those births happy births? Were they births that you look back on positively? Or did you also go in with a certain amount of anxiety and trepidation?
I think every time I gave birth, I was afraid. And I think that's normal. There's a kind of healthy fear that comes with giving birth that is, we mustn't sort of try and gloss over that and pretend, oh, it's just like any other day in your life. It's like a trip around the supermarket. You know you're about to do something monumental. Even with my third baby, having done it twice already, I was scared. But I think there's a difference between that and debilitating fear that just, you know, means you just can't cope with it. I had of my first baby in hospital. I suppose that was probably the most complicated birth. I was induced and then ended up having a forceps delivery. And that made me feel really, really scared for my second birth because I didn't really have any confidence in my body. I thought, I've never gone into labor. Maybe my body can't go into labor. Why didn't I go into labor when I was supposed to? And not only that, I've never really pushed a baby out either because I had help to get the baby out. So even though it was my second baby, I still felt like it was unproven that I could do it. And so I had a home birth in a birth pool, and really all the way through, I was full of doubt, full of anxiety, full of fear. I had a really good cry at one point in the birth pool, and my midwives were amazing, and they just stayed back and they just let me find in myself the courage and the ability to do it. And I did, and I had a fantastic you know, no issues home birth. And my third baby I had at home in a pool as well. So for me, that was like really a healing experience, because it made me realize that I actually could do it. You know, I did have it in me, and I think those experiences made me feel like I, you know, a bit evangelical about wanting to help other women to have those sorts of experiences as well, because it is such a fabulous, it's so different to give birth like in that way, where you feel that you did it yourself under your own steam with the power of your own body. And also to have that kind of midwifery care where the women who are attending you instill you with confidence and believe in you as well, and they have the confidence in you to stay back until they're really needed. They weren't standing around me shouting push.
It probably shows I've been watching the wrong kind of televisual dramas, clearly. But let's move on to the positive birth book.
No, you haven't. I mean, this happens to women. You haven't at all. I mean, it's unusual to have a birth like I did, where the midwives have that confidence to stay back. You know, they call it they call it something like intuitive crochet, they call it, or something. So they, or, you know, intuitive tea drinking. So they're in the room drinking their tea or knitting, literally. But they're there, they're connected to you, and they know exactly what's going on and when to take action and when to sit on their hands and do nothing.
The Positive Birth book, of course, published 5 years ago now, regular on the bestsellers list, etc. Was that very much your attempt to reframe the narrative, Millie, to actually at least put out the line that actually, yes, there are challenges, but at the same time, don't go in with a negative mindset, otherwise it's not going to help the issue?
Yes, absolutely it was. And I came into writing it as someone who had, you know, prior to parenting, worked as a therapist and studied a lot of psychology. So I was very interested in the whole mind-body relationship and mindset thing, and how, you know, negative expectations can set you up for a, you know, negative experience and vice versa. So a lot of the book is based around that. It's based around mindset and positive thinking, but also realistic thinking. It's not, you know, trying to gloss over anything. So there's a great section in there which everybody really loves, which where I broke down labor into 14 stages. Well, normally it's broken down into 3 stages, but in my book I broke it down into 14 stages. And then I got real women and I said to them, okay, this is the stage, this is stage 10. Tell me exactly what that was like. So that section is just other women's voices explaining, you know, what it actually, the blow by blow, what giving birth is actually like. And I think stuff like that really helps with fear, because it's the unknown that we're frightened of. And if someone explains to you and tells you the actual truth about something, you know, it doesn't have to be even be a rosy picture, but even just hearing this is what it's actually going to be like can help your confidence go up.
Positive Birth Movement, we talked about this briefly, I mentioned it briefly earlier, it was a global network of antenatal discussion groups. Is it still likely to emerge? I mean, it ran between 2012 and 2021. Was there a reason in terms of where you kind of felt, that's it, I've done all I need to do, I can say no more, it's all over?
Yeah, I mean, there was a variety of reasons why I closed the network. It was incredibly difficult to sustain. I mean, really, it was a grassroots movement, and rather than a kind of money-making operation. So it's very difficult to sustain that over the, you know, a long period of time. Mm. And, you know, for personal reasons, I just felt like it was time for me to move on from sort of carrying. It was quite a weight to carry, and I carried it for quite a long time. But in many ways, you know, it has carried on, because the concept is women coming together to talk to each other about birth, you know, in a group. So there are lots of the positive birth groups that started up as a result of the positive birth movement that are still going. They just call themselves like a positive birth meeting or a birth chat. And that idea that we don't have to have a teacher teaching us, this is your pelvis, this is the baby coming through the pelvis. That, I mean, there's a place for that in antenatal education. But the idea of the positive birth movement is women supporting women, telling their birth stories, talking about their fears, coming together. And that concept has carried on anyway without me, which is great.
Culturally, of course, the very notion of globalization, there are a whole range of different issues and areas that impact in terms of the way different cultures view the whole birthing process. Did you do any research in terms of obviously the difference between a woman giving birth in Lagos, for instance, as opposed to Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting and complicated. And then there's different periods in history as well where birth has been very different. So quite often people will say, as a reason, you know, for explaining why or birth is so dangerous, women just have to do what they're told sort of thing. They'll say, look at what happens to women in certain countries in the world or certain periods in history. But it's a bit more complicated than that, because it depends what you're talking about. But in some countries in the world, they don't have the same medical training or midwifery training that we have here. They might have different geography, so they might have much poorer access to medical help if it's needed. And they might have poor diets, which might mean they have bone structural issues, or it might be that they give birth a lot younger, which also can cause problems. So you know, it's complicated, basically. Yeah. So when we talk about how safe birth is, we need to stay focused on the UK, really, if we're talking to women in the UK. And in the UK, it's incredibly safe.
So let's assume you get the call from the BBC to do an updated version and they want you as an advisor for Call the Midwife for the 21st century. What advice would you actually run with them? What would you actually say? this is what we need to be aware of, chaps.
Yeah, well, I think it would just be great if we saw a wider variety of births on TV, although the dramatic hospital births are probably better, you know, more exciting, entertaining viewing than a sort of very slow, happy water birth at home, the kind that I had. But I think as well, you know, it'd be really good to raise awareness of choice. So, you know, still, even though it's, you know, we've got a legacy talking about different times in history. You know, if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, like you call the midwife time and around about, you know, a bit beyond that, women weren't given a choice at all in what happened to them in childbirth. They were quite often shaved, given an enema, given particular pain relieving drugs without any notion of consent. It wasn't, nobody even talked about consent in those decades. You just did what you were told. And it would be foolish to think that we've completely got beyond that. You know, we're still, it's not that long ago. I was born in 1975. So it's not 100 years ago or anything. And, you know, we've still got women in the modern system who don't realise that they have a voice, who don't realise that they can say no to things, ask questions, ask for a different healthcare provider if they don't feel comfortable, you know, challenge what they're being told. You know, women just don't necessarily always know this. So I think program makers could do a real service on that front by just, even with a narrator over the top of one born every minute, you could easily say, you know, Michelle has made this choice today because she feels this. The other things that she could have chosen to do are that, you know, and then suddenly the viewer's got this notion, oh, okay, I didn't realize that Michelle could chose this. I thought it was just what was happening, you know.
Indeed, that there was, in fact, a choice might be an interesting line as well to pursue.
Yeah.
The Positive Birth book, presumably still available from all good booksellers and online areas?
Yes, it is. The updated edition has just come out and it's got a brand new cover. So make sure you buy the one with the lovely sort of golden orangey coloured cover, not the white, the old white cover, which is the original version, unless you want the original version. And it's available on Amazon and all the other book websites and hopefully in your local bookshop as well.
Lily, it's been fascinating sharing some of your thoughts today. And I think certainly there are a whole range of issues that you opened up with. For the moment, though, Millie Hill, ace author, feminist, and author, of course, of the classic The Positive Birth book. Huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Clearly, the cost of living crisis is impacting folk across all strata of society. But as is always the case, if you're on a low income to start off with, then maybe you're going to be impacted even more. And indeed, 47% of people on a low income feel out of control in their daily lives, with 66% citing high energy prices as the reason for feeling a lack of control. So can technology actually help us sort this thing out? Well, we're delighted to welcome psychotherapist Zoe Aston to the program to discuss this whole situation. Zoe, welcome to the Midweek Drive. Clearly, that whole sense of being out of control can lead to despair, can lead to depression, can lead to all sorts of challenges.
Absolutely. And when I hear the words out of control, what I hear is that people are feeling really, really vulnerable. And there are things that they are feeling powerless over and helpless towards that are affecting not only their financial health, but also their emotional and psychological health as well. So to answer your question in your introduction there, technology is available to support us, but not just financially, also emotionally and psychologically. And the way to think about it is that, you know, the technology itself might not actually change your financial situation, but what it can do is help you manage the stress and the anxiety, and sometimes even the panic that can come with stretched finances. Things like smart meters are really helpful because they tell you exactly what you're spending on a minute by minute basis. And that's not, I'm not saying that because knowing what you're spending is going to help you reduce your bills. I'm saying that because those little feelings that you have when you look at your smart meter or you check how much money you've spent are much more manageable than the feelings you might get when you get a bill at the end of the month and you haven't had eyes on it all month. So technology is a really helpful way to, yes, help us look after our financial health, but to also help us focus on our emotional and psychological well-being as well.
Back in the 20th century, of course, there was the classic case of people who would literally just not open their envelopes and not open their bills. They'd let them pile up and so on. Have we simply replaced one form of snail mail, and in terms of final demands and so on, with another situation which certainly in terms of budgeting apps and money advice websites, etc., can also lead to challenges as well?
I mean, everything has its challenges, it's true, but I think the sort of snail mail and not opening envelopes and checking bills, having that option, if given it, people will often use it because it means that in the moment they feel a bit better. They can avoid those feelings of anxiety. They can avoid feeling stressed about money. They just don't look at it. So with the budgeting apps, the smart meters, with things like Money Saving Expert, you know, all the free resources that are available to us, you can actually keep an eye on it, but you sort of have to train your mind to do that. You have to retrain your neural pathways to be like, actually, this is a good thing for me. And the instant gratification of not checking in the long run doesn't do us that many favours.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, clearly, this survey was commissioned by Smart Energy GB, and we're delighted to welcome to the programme now from Smart Energy GB, Victoria Bacon. Victoria, how are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. We'll be talking with Zoe there, obviously, about the challenges and the sense that people feel out of control in terms of this. Is simply fitting a smart meter the solution, or is it just something which can be a part of a tool, a portfolio of things that can actually help people deal with budgeting costs and challenges?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a standalone solution on its own, but it is one small tool as part of your overall kind of armory, if you like, to tackle some of these challenges. I think, you know, one of the challenging things for people, I think, is it with this sense of control is, you know, being able to sort of break it down into sort of manageable bite-sized chunks. And that's what a smart meter does. It's one of those pieces of kit that can really help you because it provides you with real-time data, real-time information on your energy use, which then helps you to understand, okay, for example, which are the energy hungry appliances in my home, or what are the behaviors that I'm doing which might be increasing energy use, or indeed, you know, how I can maybe reduce that as well. The other really important thing they do is give you accurate bills, and again that again just adds to that sense of just feeling a little bit more in control in what is a very difficult situation at a very difficult time for people.
There have been a number of stories, of course, about smart meters not necessarily being as smart as they're originally billed to actually be. Is that something which Smart Energy GB has managed to address? Has it kind of fixed the challenges that certainly sort of led to people saying, but it's not telling me what I'm doing, it's not allowing me to switch from energy providers, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, there were some historic problems with the first generation of smart meters. Most of those now have been fixed. Most of those SMETS1 meters, as they're called, have been brought onto a new network. I think we've got to bear in mind this is a huge, major technological program, you know, one of the most ambitious that this country has introduced in a generation. So there have been a few tech glitches along the way, but as I say, those in the main have been addressed. The other really important thing to bear in mind, I think, is that there are two pieces of important kit that come with the smart meter. It's smart meter itself, which is the thing which captures that really important data and enables accurate billing, but then also the IHD, the in-home display, which is the display thing that you see on your counter. So both of those are important. Both of those play a different role. I would say, though, that if you are having any problems with your IHD, that doesn't mean that your smart meter isn't working. It still is working, and it still is providing all that really important data to ensure you're getting accurate bills as well.
Seem to be a magnificent seven bits of technology that help us feel a bit more in control, Zoe. We've talked about smart meters. There are obviously budgeting apps, parental controls, meal planning apps, coupon apps, online emotional support and money advice websites. Is there a danger that we can sometimes, as I say, rely too much on the technology and we forget that actually perhaps what we ultimately need is some kind of personalized contact as well?
I think, you know, what we're always aiming for is balance. Ultimately, how we reduce stress is to work towards balance. And so what we want is a kind of interdependent lifestyle where we're able to use the technology that's available to us, but also lean on those people around us. And if we're having a difficult time, to be able to open up to close friends and family. So I think there's you know, there's room for maneuver and everyone is different and everyone's needs are slightly different. But ultimately you're aiming for, or what I want to empower people to aim for, is a balanced lifestyle where they can use the tools that are available to them. So all the ones that you just mentioned, and also have those relationships and emotional supports in their interpersonal lives as well.
You mentioned the key B word there, of course, balance. That's sometimes something which seems to be so easy to attain and yet so difficult at the same time. It's almost a contradiction in terms. But just returning briefly to Victoria, what apps do you use, Victoria, to actually minimise your stress and anxiety?
It's a good question. Well, I use my bank here. My bank has a very good app which helped me to budget and keep an eye on my budget on a monthly basis. In terms of just information, Money Saving Expert is a great website. There are other really, really helpful websites out there, Money Magpie and others, again, which have got really useful information and again can sort of signpost you to other information. So personally, I find those really useful, but I mean, there are obviously a whole swathe of others out there. And what's great about them as well is that they're free, of course. So free, very helpful information.
I think in a sense, they need to be given if people are on low incomes to start off with. The last thing they can really afford is to actually be shelling out for more app subscriptions and so on. But that's another issue. Where can people go to find further information, Victoria?
Yes. So if you like more information about how to get a smart meter installed, and they are at no additional cost to people as well, and installation typically takes a couple of hours, you can come to our website, which is smartenergygb.org.
Victoria Bacon from Smart Energy GB and psychotherapist Zoe Aston, huge thanks. And let's hope we can speak again when people are feeling a little less anxious.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah.
McBeal. Do you remember Ally McBeal back in the day, back in the 20th century? Yes, extraordinary. Anyway, one of the key things that came out of course of that wonderful Calista Flockhart starring series was the term the ick, which has now re-emerged in terms of popular culture and is very much in vogue with respect to that series you may also have heard of called Love Island. But what is the ick? How do we actually deal with it? How does it relate to relationships? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it a challenging thing? Let's find out by discussing the matter in detail with ace psychologist and general all-round super individual, Anna Williamson. How are you, Anna?
Oh, Alex, you can come again. What an intro. I mean, I'm enjoying that. An all-round super individual. I'm taking that. I'm taking that, Alex.
That's perfectly okay and richly deserved. So clearly, Anna, you're not somebody who would ever have suffered from the ick at all in any shape or form, because you'd just be practically perfect in every way.
Wow.
But what about this whole notion of the ick? Is it just a case of when all those little habits that maybe we thought were quite charming in the early stages of a relationship suddenly become quite problematic, whether it's a messy house, whether it's personal habits, all sorts of other areas?
Yes. The ick. So, I mean, in a nutshell, the ick is not a good thing. OK, but it is a thing. OK, it is out there. And just to clarify as well, what is, I'm so happy to have teamed up with Woo Woo, who are an incredible brand, feminine care brand, and tongue firmly in cheek. But this is what is, we're seeing so much of this in the dating world. And it's when attraction suddenly flips on a complete, 180 to disgust. And exactly as you say, Alex, it can be anything that can trigger it. It can be anything from just suddenly having bad breath to suddenly, pulling out a really embarrassing dance move to wearing bad shoes. I mean, trust me, I have heard it all. And I hate to, I feel like I've let myself down in your eyes, Alex, because I have to admit, I have felt the ick in my dating past.
Wow. Well, there we are. I mean, I think we'll have to sort of just deal with the shock revelation from that point of view in good time.
Have you, Alex? Come on, fess it up. Have you been in the dating world where someone has done something? Because let me tell you, our research we've done with Woo Woo says that one in four of us experience the ick in the UK. And I reckon you might be one of those one in four.
Well, no, let's not go there at this particular point in time. It is interesting, though, that given that the Lincolnshire show is literally on our doorstep, and that might well be, certainly for young farmers, one of those ways in which they do get together. But for people in Lincoln, the ick is most likely to happen in the first month of dating, or indeed the 1 year point, which many people would actually still argue is still in the early stages of a relationship. So is it a case of sometimes we are seen to be a bit too harsh? We're actually expecting perfection because we have so many media representations of perfection. If we don't get that absolutely perfect partner, that's it. It's all over. It's time to scrap it now.
Spot on. And I think that's exactly it. What we've seen through with trends with the dating world is that there is a very concerning measuring of what is perfection in inverted commas. Instagram, TikTok, filters, celebrities. And I think a lot of people in the data world are trying to strive for what they deem to be perfection. We live in a society now where we are encouraged that we can have it all. But actually, what is that? And I think we are losing sight of the fact that perfection rarely exists. And also, do we really want perfection? Are we perfect? Can we all honestly sit here and say, in a relationship, I am 100% perfect? Absolutely not. I know I certainly can't say that. And I think it's not about lowering our standards, but it is about lowering our expectations on what we deem to be perfect. And also just not being too Judge Judy about what are just natural personality traits sometimes. Someone could just be having an off day, personal hygiene. In the research that we did with Woo Woo, it said that women were more likely to get the ick than men, but men still did get the ick, and actually personal hygiene and bad habits and bad chat were sort of amongst those top reasons for it. But they're easily fixable. For example, it's hot right now. Okay, we can all be guilty. I speak for myself now. you can have a bad day. You might need to freshen up, have a bit of a shower. Now, if my husband got the ick just because, you know, I perhaps needed a bit of a shower, I would feel pretty disappointed and I would feel pretty upset about that. But it's an easy fix. Grab yourself your favorite woo-woo shower gel. You know what? Turn it into a fun event. Let's have a shower together. Let's freshen up together. You know, we have to tease out the positives in life. You know, we are programmed to focus on the negatives more than the positives. So when it comes to the ick, I think it is becoming the easy option to just focus in and pinpoint the bad things, as opposed to really looking and focusing on the good things. And what are those quirks? And if something that maybe you think is icky, could there be a positive in that? You know, that person that busts out some dance moves on, you know, at their mate's wedding, and you're thinking that's a bit embarrassing and it gives you the ick. Could you perhaps reframe that into, wow, isn't that amazing? They have so much self-confidence. They can just get out there and just be who they are on that dance floor. You know, there's a lot more to it. And I think there's a lot more to be said for the person that has the ick than the person who is on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, I'm not sure Calista Flockhart ever actually thought about ickiness when she connected with Harrison Ford or vice versa, but that's another issue entirely. And I'm still back in the Ally McBeal scenario, which is probably icky in its own system. Anna, should we actually tell the other person we have the ick? I mean, if it's a case of, look, there's a classic sort of case of clutter or messiness or untidiness, etc., is it best to be upfront? Or is it best to actually say, well, I'll try and hide it away, sweep it all under the carpet, and then hopefully all will work out okay?
No, never do that. Never sweep anything under the carpet, because that will just fester and fester and fester. It's about what the ick is, really. What is causing the ick? And can you communicate that in a kind way? So it depends what it is. You know, if it's personal hygiene, for example, or something around that, you're going to have to be sensitive around the way that you issue that, because what we don't want to do is confront someone with the ick and then knock their self-esteem, because that will just completely be the kiss of death for that relationship anyway. You know, personal hygiene, going, you smell, I don't fancy you, that's not really going to work. Okay, it's about buoying people up and just saying, do you know what, I love it when you're fresh out of a shower, you know, I really fancy you, you know, when you've just, you know, had yourself a little scrub. You know, that's a different way of framing it, but essentially it's the same thing. If it is about clutter or someone being messy and that's giving you the ick, you know, yeah, I think those are slightly more landscapes to be able to say, look, do you know what, I'll be honest, I feel more attracted to you when you are a bit more, you know, up with it, you know, making things a little bit more tidy, as opposed to when you're a bit of a scruff bag and a bit, you know, a bit slovenly. So I think it's about choosing your battles, and it's about asking yourself, what is the outcome of me actually addressing what the ick is? And that will help motivate you and give you the right judgment call on whether it's worth bringing up.
Perhaps the couples could tidy up together. I'm just saying, it's a way forward, perhaps.
Or maybe, you know, I actually think tidying up together is a really, really, really sensible thing to do.
Well, there we are. That sort of builds a whole range of pieces within that. Anna, how can people find out further information about this fabulous survey and indeed this whole question of the ick?
All you need to do is go over to woowoo.fun, which is the feminine care brand. All of the info's there, as well as all of their amazing products. It's a really fun brand, clue in the title. And yeah, I just love the way that they have just, you know, they're not afraid to tackle the difficult topics, and they do it in such a really fresh and fun way. So yeah, just head over to woowoo.fun.
And I feel actually that you should really have actually already been providing counselling therapy for all the contestants within Love Island, because certainly they need it. And you know, probably that's another aspect you can actually work through. I mean, you're already dating expert with Celebs Go Dating. So you know, maybe you need to just open that out so that other people can benefit, Anna, from your sage advice.
Well, I'm very open to it. Yes.
Anna Williamson, dating expert extraordinaire and all round wonderful person. As I say, unlikely to have any icks, even though she might admit to that, whatever. Take care and happy non-icking.
Thanks, Alex.